Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So it's great to have Dr. Tanvir Ahmed back at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him very briefly. It's his second occasion here. He graduated in Arts and Medicine at the University of Sydney. He works as a psychiatrist, but some time ago he took a break from medicine and went into foreign affairs journalism and worked for SBS, and then he returned to medicine. He's probably best known to some of you as a columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald, but his career is quite varied. He's a member of the Advertising Standards Board, he's a member of the board of the Smith family. He's also been a games show host on Channel 7. It's always handy to have a psychiatrist as a games show. But tonight he's here in having recently returned from a visit to Pakistan, which I think was partly funded by the Australian government. And Dr. Ahmed's going to speak for us on the crisis in Islamic states, Iran and Pakistan. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. It's a pleasure to be speaking at the Sydney Institute again. It was quite cosy tonight as well. Shielding ourselves from the cold outside. I'm thrilled with the interest too. I must say I wasn't expecting such interest. Pakistan's been in the news heavily. In some respects it's quieted down a little, but I think it's still a very tense situation. And obviously Iran's also been in the news, but was quickly flooded by news of Michael Jackson's death. I think that killed off any interest in Iran. So I think it's certainly an interesting time to be speaking about both topics. And in some respects, it's coincidental that I'm putting them together. While they share some similarities, I think there's a host of differences as well. And I've decided to speak to them as a combination, primarily just because they happen to be in the news at the same time. But at the same time, I will speak about why there are some similarities and ask you to reflect on that. Now, of course, the obvious similarity is that they're both rooted in Islam. Now, it's debatable whether they can be technically called Islamic states. But what they have in common right now is a period of significant instability. And we can see that even from our own armchairs. Now, both countries have a myriad of factors that are contributing to that. But I think it's still rooted in a foundation that both countries have, I guess, are still fundamentally based on a kind of Islamic utopian ideal. And I will also argue some of this utopian ideal overlaps a little with communist ideas, which some of the, I guess, thinkers of the 20th century, some of the, say, political Islamist thinkers of the 20th century, were inspired by. This is something I spoke about last time when I was at the Sydney Institute, and I'll touch on some of that as well. Now, first of all, Iran is constitutionally an Islamic state, in that Sharia law and the Grand Ayatollah, which is a fantastic title, has the ultimate say on law, and not the democratic vote. So I think by any definition, that's a true Islamic state. Now, Pakistan's identity was founded on Islam, but there's an inherent conflict in the way it began. And whether this should be a secular state for India's Muslims or a theocratic one. And it constitutionally defines itself as secular, but at the same time it says that no law should contradict Sharia law. So then again, it's open for debate. Does that make it an Islamic state or not? Now, depending on what your view of what constitutes an Islamic state, there are a myriad of views, I might add, from a strict Sharia law ruled by a despotic leader, which Iran comes close to exemplifying, to one based only on Sharia principles, or not at all. There's certainly a school of thought that would argue that the Islamic State is essentially a myth, that it was more an idea in imagination, or say a kind of a collective identity, rather than some sort of territorial idea. And I guess the school of thought that would argue for this would suggest the modern idea of Islamic State is a post-colonial reaction. So it's more something that's happened in the last 100, 150 years, particularly as the Ottoman Empire crumbled, as more a reaction to, I guess, well, Western power. It's almost a form of protest that an Islamic State should be formed. Now, with regard to Pakistan, there are many of those who felt that the country's genesis, that there was a real historic purpose to it, that it'd be something of a beacon, if you like, for the Islamic world. Now, this fundamental conflict between what I was saying, is it a secular state for Muslims, or should it be a religious state? This is still very much at the base of the country, and it really hits you right from the beginning when you arrive in Pakistan. Now, I was only there, say, a month or so ago, and I was there for an AusAid-funded trip, and it was actually them funding the NGO UNIFEM, so it was about women's rights, and it was trying to build the body up there, and I was asked to speak in a range of towns, from Lahore, which is a very sophisticated town, and I'll speak a little bit about it, and nothing like what we may see on TV, so this is... And I guess in all... Something I've noticed, I guess, as an immigrant, you notice in a lot of, I guess, countries of the Commonwealth, there's always sections, as someone who, say, studied, coming from an immigrant background, I went to Sydney Grammar School up here, you always see sections of society which... generally the elite, who are more English than the English. This is their way of kind of projecting a kind of a sense of elite. And Pakistan and India have this probably more than anywhere else, because status is so fundamental in terms of, I guess, the social stratification. So Lahore is actually a classic place for this. So you'll see not an insignificant set who are all sort of educated at Oxbridge, and they'll have these really kind of overbearing Oxford accents, and their presence isn't kind of, it's much bigger than you would think. So you get that sense of real intelligentsia based in Lahore, but obviously that's not indicative of the wider country. Now, I'm originally born in Bangladesh, so I'm not actually from Pakistani background. So I came to Australia when I was 5 years old, and Bangladesh was Pakistan. For those of you, most of you here would probably be aware of the history, was Pakistan until 1971, until there was essentially a brutal civil war, and they split. Now, it was interesting when I visited Pakistan, people would often ask me, thinking that, was I from there, possibly, I don't know, and when I told them that I was originally from Bangladesh, but now I live in Australia. Very interestingly, and something that surprised me, most weren't terribly interested that I'd lived in Australia for the vast majority of my life. And many, many people were sort of trying to claim me as Pakistani. And in fact, I got into a kind of a tiff, it was one way, so I can hardly call it a conflict as such, where a taxi driver was verbally berating me, telling me that I was a Pakistani. And this was the second or third day I was there. It was a big surprise, but it was a real insight into the place, that there is this kind of... there's a pain there, almost, that feels like there's been some sort of divorce, and that original dream of some sort of, I guess, a beacon for the Islamic world, uniting disparate parts of, I guess, Indian Islam in particular, that it didn't work out. And that's being threatened even further now. So I think it was a very interesting insight into the place. Now, Pakistan faces the threat now of being overwhelmed by Islamic radicalism and becoming the global epicentre of terror. In fact, the most recent Indonesian bombings, I've seen some reports. Now, I'm not sure whether they're confirmed. Jared might be able to inform us of that. I certainly saw some reports suggesting that it was tied to Al-Qaeda based in Pakistan. So that gives you a sense of how, I guess... the head office, if you like, is increasingly in those badlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, the country also represents the key agent to the ongoing difficult war in Afghanistan. Now, the Taliban here is not necessarily a coherent group. It's more an umbrella term for extremists of all kinds, who often see attacking the Pakistani state as a proxy for attacking the US. So this is where it's all, again, it's part of this anti-colonial history that the subcontinent and many parts of the Arab world have too, where when they, some of these people, they blow up something relating to the Pakistan government, they see it's a blow against the US or the Great Satan, if you like. Now, I think that's receding a little. There's a quite a funny comment about Pakistan, and I think it's quite accurate. It suggests it's ruled by the three A's. So it's the army, Allah, and America. And I think it's true. I think historically it's true. And even when you're there, and certainly the journalists in me was fascinated. It was absolutely flooded. I know for a couple of years there, the New York Times and a few publications were, complaining that they couldn't get their young journalists to go out there, particularly after the Daniel Pearl incident. Whereas the Brits were usually more than happy to go there. But you didn't see that now. I feel like that's changed, because the place was flooded. If you went to Islamabad, Lahore, it was flooded with Americans from various outlets, from diplomats to NGOs to journalists. So whatever misgivings they once had, it doesn't seem to be as apparent now. Now, lurking in the shadows, as always, is the army and its associated intelligence forces, often maligned for stoking religious extremists to minimise their dominance of India. Now, the army's obsessed with India, and the majority feel the Taliban is America's war. So India thus threatens to be destabilised if Pakistan's woes continue. Now, this is all occurring in a country with 100 nuclear warheads, and they're spread out all over the country. Now, generally, my impression was that they were secure in the limited involvement I had with army officials. And I think the US believes that too, but if there was a further destabilisation, that would be under threat. Now, you've also seen recent anti-terror raids in the UK, it was early in the year, related to international students, also relating to Pakistanis. Now, they were exonerated, but you do really get this feeling that, particularly from the expatriate point of view, which will overlap with Australia, but most prominently in the UK, that what happens in Pakistan and the ideas that happen in Pakistan influence the West, particularly the Anglo-West, primarily UK, to a lesser extent the US and Australia. So it's crucial from that point of view as well. Now, from a more, official point of view, Australia, particularly with Stephen Smith, is making a big effort now at focusing on South Asia as a real priority region, one that's been neglected in the past, particularly building ties with India, but more broadly that region. And in April, one of the top commanders from Pakistan came and visited and met some of the Australian defence officials, which I think is crucial. I know a lot of the Americans suggested, for almost a decade, the US stopped a program where they would bring over, it was an exchange program, if you like, and I think it was some sort of punishment where they stopped this program. And it was a real example of, not getting that sort of influence. Often when they would go to the US, study, meet people, and they would come back with, much more liberal ideas that they may have learned or have been inspired in the US. And that was stopped for a while, and a lot of the Pentagon in particular, are seeing this as a real mistake. And I think Australia joining that too, thinking, it's trying to engage them, build some, peer-to-peer, some exchange-type contacts, which I think is a very legitimate idea. Now, I just want to illuminate the pictures with some history. I don't want to dwell on my last recall. Excuse me. Now, the proposal for a separate Muslim state in India began in the 30s. Now, it was driven by fear among India's Muslims that basically India was hell-bent on reinventing itself as a Hindu colossus. Now, the country was formed in 1947, as many of you would know, essentially in the shadow of one of the biggest massacres in human history, almost 1 million people dying in the space of a week over partition. Now, in spite of the formation of Pakistan, the formation was really led by the intelligentsia. Derivative of which is this class, if you like, that I've mentioned, based in Lahore and some of the capital cities. But within a year of Pakistan's formation, Muhammad Jinnah, who was the kind of the twin of Gandhi, both sort of Oxford lawyers, gone back to their homelands and sort of led their country to democracy, if you like. He died within a year. And his key lieutenant, if you know, a guy called Ali Khan, was assassinated a year after that. So suddenly, I guess, the forces that led to the formation of Pakistan were kind of wiped out very rapidly. And right away, the leadership fell to military rulers. Now, even when Pakistan was formed, from the overall Indian state, it got a third of the army. So it got a very large percentage of the army, but only 17% of the assets of British India. So it was poor, but had a lot of guns. And that really exemplifies, gives a real insight into how things are now. Now, the state came into being as a federation, was trying to build six different ethnic groups together. Now, these groups had little in common, and I guess Islam was seen as the glue that would keep them together. And for this glue, this is also the reason, not dissimilar, you look at states like Iraq, where you see Saddam ruled with an iron fist, and once he left, you sort of got a sense that he was the only secular force, if you like. It was the only way of almost, I'm sure there probably would have been less brutal ways, but you get a sense how some countries are only barely states. And in some respects, I don't think Pakistan is not unlike that, where it's quite a loosely held country, very different groups. And I guess it's no coincidence that a more radical type of Islam may be taking shape there, because it's seen as a way, it's kind of a way of trying to maintain the country with a kind of ideological force. Now, Pakistan has also understood and organised itself as a national security state with strong Cold War ties to the United States. And while the US has had communism and then terrorism as its focus, Pakistan has always been about India. Now, its geographical position has allowed it to collect rent from the US. So while it appears, certainly on the numbers, you would certainly consider it poor, when you visit, it does not feel as poor as when you visit India, which is interesting. Certainly some of the cities I visit, it actually looks relatively wealthy from afar, at least. That quickly changes when you visit schools and hospitals, which I'll speak about. Now, the country's attempts at democracy essentially took an unexpected turn when Benazir Bhutto's father, whose name was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, he inherited power in 1971, and this was after the civil war that led to the formation of Bangladesh. Now, he found the party called the Pakistan People's Party, PPP. Their slogan was Bread, Clothing and Shelter. So very much a call to the ordinary aspirations of the people. Now, this was a break from the norm. And this is where I makes me think, like many parts of the world, often I guess the country's elites would outwardly support democracy, but when it starts taking shape, it can be quite unsettling. And I think this was the case in Pakistan, where democracy was probably more in name, and suddenly there was almost a chance that it was beginning to take some sort of shape. And the military and much of Washington viewed Bhutto as a dangerous rabble-rouser, and he was overthrown in 1977. Now, Bhutto's army's chief of staff, Zia-ul-Haq. Now, he deposed the Prime Minister and had him executed on trumped-up charges before ruling over a decade. Now, his period of power and its religious dimension is crucial for understanding the role of religion in Pakistani life today. In many respects, this was the period where there was an entire re-evaluation of what the glue should be that held the country together. And in fact, it was Zia who sort of saw the country more as a theocratic one, overseen by the military, rather than a secular state for Muslims. He crushed all opposition and introduced a kind of austere Islam into all of Pakistan's life and institutions. He also changed aspects of the education system. And this was a fascinating thing, which I'd never really seen until I visited. And I met some of the journalists. I met a particular journalist who was the education reporter for Dawn there, which is one of the biggest English papers there. And he spoke about how many of the history of the region prior to Islam coming was kind of being steadily edited out of textbooks. And you do get this sense the hero, the mythical hero is always this sort of Islamic conqueror. And it essentially denies thousands of years of history of the region. And there's also kind of creeping sort of conspiracy theories or anti-Hindu sentiment that creeps into textbooks. And he showed me some examples, you know, vary from kids' stories to science textbooks. It's very, very worrying. And I think there's a bit of a more of a focus on this now, so hopefully there may be some, amendments. But this was one of the most interesting things I saw while I was there. Now, Zia was, aided by the fact that his reign coincided with the CIA's war on the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Now, it was Zia's military and intelligence officials who controlled the Afghan Mujahideen, distributed the funds from America, and even shared aspects of their worldview. Now, this mirrors the situation with parts of the military and the Taliban today, where they have the purse strings. That's been, rectified a little by Obama's administration, but it mirrors a lot what happened through the Soviet war in Afghanistan. Now, by the end of Zia's reign in 1988, he died in a plane crash. He transformed Pakistani politics away from its secular origins. The secular leaders that followed him, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, were pretty much beholden to the army until it was made more official when Musharraf made it, more formally the army ruled. Now, Musharraf actually did make some attempts to give more legitimacy to the secular institutions, mainly the media. And arguably, this played a role in toppling him later. But these changes altered Pakistan so fundamentally that it sort of foreshadowed the growing Islamic militancy we see now and the complex relationship between its army and the Taliban. Now, what really tipped it over was the US attacks after September 11 in Afghanistan, which essentially led to a whole bunch of Taliban, Pashtun Taliban, on the Afghanistan side, going over onto the Pakistani side, where they were sort of met by their brethren, the Pakistani Pashtun. Now, the other key trend is the US in particular now basically is not allowing the army supporting any extremist elements in their battles against India. So what you're really seeing over the last couple of years in particular is a messy divorce between a set of extremist groups whose key, reason for existence was to resist India, particularly in Kashmir. And now that the army's effectively cut them loose, they're without purpose, and many are realigning themselves with the Taliban, with the Afghan, the Pashtun Taliban towards the Afghan border. And this explains why in the last couple of years in particular, you're suddenly seeing attacks in, the heart of Pakistan, in Lahore, what's called the Punjab, where most of the population live. You're suddenly seeing attacks in Lahore, in Islamabad, these parts, because these, previous Kashmir-devoted extremists are suddenly linking up with their Afghan or the Western side's brethren and being able to coordinate attacks on, far more, it's the heart of Pakistan. So this is a real dangerous change. Couple of months ago, one of the key moderate clerics who lived in, I think it was in Lahore, essentially just got assassinated in broad daylight. And this was almost a signal, to the authorities that they could strike almost anywhere at will, not unlike the attacks on the Sri Lanka cricket team. So this was a real turn of events. Now, what exacerbates the problem even further is the shocking state of civil society. And this is what I was referring to when I was talking about, outwardly, it really doesn't look, in many respects, Pakistan looks as wealthy, if not wealthier, than India. But I think the underbelly is markedly different. And I'll just give you some basic kind of stats, a bit of a sense of that. And this, the crisis in the civil society really tests the legitimacy of the government. Now, in this case, the rise of extremism mirrors parts of the other parts of the Islamic world. I guess where groups like, say, Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood gain prestige not from their religious credentials, but the fact that they often better at providing basic services. And I think in Pakistan, it's been the case, particularly in the Northwest Frontier, where the Taliban were often much better at providing cheap, swift, effective justice. Now, it may have been fairly brutal justice, but for parts of the population, it was still seen as much more efficient than what the state could offer. Now, some of the facts relating to the failure of civil society. Now, half of all women are literate. Recent UN stats said that 40% of schools had no textbooks. The country spends 2.5% of its GDP on education. It's one of a tiny handful of states, I think along 5 or 6 in the world, that have yet to eradicate polio. 1 in 200 women die in childbirth, as compared to 1 in, say, 6,000 in the developed world. And 500,000 kids each year die of diarrheal diseases, which again is probably in the top, the worst 10 in the world. Now, the police sector is particularly deprived. To give you an idea, of US aid in 2007, $700 million in US aid was given, of which $5 million went to local police and security forces. So you can see how the army just dominates the state, sucks up a lot of the funding, and much of the rest of the institutions is really just meagre. And the police and security is really making it very difficult to... it's probably no surprise then that, say, the attacks of the Sri Lankan cricket team essentially walked away in broad daylight, got into the cars and casually kind of drove off. I think it's an indication of how... ineffective and deprived the police sector is. The Pakistan also, in terms of the economy, it was virtually bankrupt last year, required a big IMF loan. It has the riskiest government debt in Asia, and half the population live on US $2 a day. And interestingly, with the financial crisis, remittance payments, which formed almost 10% of the economy, are under real threat, particularly from the Gulf. This is where, I guess, amongst the biggest share of remittance payments come from in parts of South Asia, Pakistan in particular. Now, in spite of this, and I alluded to this before, that there's a very significant liberal intelligentsia in Pakistan and a flourishing print and electronic media, part of which can be credited by Musharraf. Early this year, there was the culmination of a courageous and sustained lawyers' movement to reinstate the judges dismissed unconstitutionally by Musharraf. And this was called, by the New York Times at least, as one of the biggest, I guess, democratic outpourings of civil unrest in an Islamic country, probably in the last 40 or 50 years. So it was very impressive in that sense. Now, at the same time, there's also growing religiosity that's threatening them. For example, while I was there, this was in May, while I was there, there was a big hoo-ha where one of the major, I guess, women's Christian colleges, and this was a very sort of proud institution, hundreds of years old, received some sort of threats, very vague threats, that if the women weren't covering up, that they would be bombed. Now, it's not clear who made the threats or whether they even existed, to be honest, but the school board met very quickly, and within a week, they issued a thing where suddenly women weren't allowed to wear jeans and had to have their heads covered. So this was almost 150 years of sort of secular liberal tradition overturned. So it's a sense of the fear. Now, it's not clear these threats existed or anything was going to happen, but it was a sense of, I guess, the psychology of the place, that even the secular and the very liberal elements of the country were starting to really feel some kind of pressure, real or imagined. Now, there's also a lot of changes in local practices. For example, and this is actually something I've seen in the expatriate communities too. I remember probably the last 5-10 years, I've even noticed in, say, the Bangladeshi community living here, the Pakistani community, where things like, simple things like saying, the way they say goodbye, it may have been secular in the past, but now often Allah is incorporated in it. So you have this sort of kind of religious dimension to a lot of simple daily practices. And again, there's a lot of different forces affecting this, but I would again talk about how this is a shift from a secular way of living to a more religious way of living, and it's partly tied to what's going on in their home countries, particularly Pakistan. Now, for example, also the year before I was there, there was a secular kite-flying festival. And this was some sort of tradition that Lahore had for many years, I think. And it was overturned, largely for a number of reasons, but one of them was that quite a number of mullahs, influential mullahs, suggested that this was anti-Islamic and shouldn't be upheld. It's a lot of what seemingly trivial, and they are, but it gives a sense of some of the trends and the fears that are sort of taking place. Now, obviously, now the army has confronted the Taliban. We have a massive humanitarian crisis in it. It seems like 2 million people. Stephen Smith was there fairly recently, I think. And we're not getting, great reports from the area at the moment, but it does seem to be reasonably effective. And public opinion has certainly shifted, where much of the public now are against the Taliban, who they see as very brutal, and certainly not promising the ideals that, that was hoped for, at least. Now, Australia's been at the forefront of the relief effort. Now, Stephen Smith visited earlier this year, as I said, and we're also on a UN group called Democratic Friends of Pakistan, and we've increased our level of aid to the region. Now, the available policy options, which I guess stem from what I'm saying, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but essentially, obviously, continue the fight against the Taliban, improve civil society, and I don't think I can stress that part enough, support the secular moderate forces, but the challenge here, similar to right throughout the Islamic world, is how to support them without making them look like stooges of the West. So there's always this difficult balance, and it's not easily done, because I think there was a period where, you know, the US in particular, they often would receive advice, you know, flood the secular moderate forces, but then they would look like patsies, kind of stooges, and they would lose all legitimacy within their homelands. And obviously engaging India and Kashmir is crucial as well. This is a real driver of, extremist ideas or resentment. And I think India really needs to be brought to the table here. There's certainly a lot of high-ranking officers, both within the region and outside, who sort of feel India's been a little bit sort of intransigent in recent years about the Kashmir issue. And there were probably real opportunities during Musharraf's reign to have made more progress. Now, I want to compare the situation more briefly with Iran. Now, I'll obviously not do it justice, given the unprecedented developments there. Now, I've never visited Iran, but I've had much to do with its local communities as a journalist. Now, most that live in Australia came after the Shah was overthrown in 79, or they came as refugees through the Iran-Iraq War. And I know the dealings I've had with some of the Iranian community here more recently, there's a real yearning. There's a lot of excitement about current events, and there's a real yearning, for some more fundamental change. Now, Iran has many differences with Pakistan. For example, it is a former Islamic state, I think, often referred to as a revolutionary theocracy. Its version of Islam is, of course, the Shia branch. Now, as a psychiatrist, I find the Shia thing quite intriguing, really. It's all based on sort of martyrdom and kind of this self-flagellation and violent death. And often the real themes are sort of sacrifice and dispossession and mourning. And I guess in its tragic ways, it came to the surface during the Iran-Iraq War. We had things like the Ayatollah would send 12-year-olds on bicycles towards Iraqi machine gun groups, and essentially all getting wiped out in an instant. And it is funny how that plays out, and it's almost, poetic in a way, and hopefully in a positive sense, that you've had this image of the young woman who was killed on the streets as a possibly the martyr to end this culture of kind of Shia martyrdom, if you like. But that remains to be seen. Now, Iran, some of the key things, Iran has a much better functioning civil society than Pakistan, and a very deep ancient history. And Martin Amis recently wrote in The Guardian, he said, Iran makes China look like an adolescent. Iranians worship their poets as much as their clerics. What we have right now is essentially a clerical superstructure sitting atop a society that has in many ways become secular over the last 20 years. And in many respects, the revolution has contributed to it. Women have been educated throughout. 60% of university students are women now in Iran. And what we're really seeing is a sort of fundamental battle between the nationalist revolutionaries and versus the reform-minded internationalists playing out. I think Obama's election has had a bit to do with that. Because suddenly, I guess, one of the key myths the Iranian authorities could always play out is the whole, we have this victim group and we're trying to shield ourselves from the great Satan. Suddenly, these offers of engagement are kind of making that those sort of overtures less legitimate. Now, I think there was a period before the Mousavi rise, which actually happened very late. Now, prior to this election, now, granted, I think I was following it terribly closely, but most people didn't really predict what's happened in recent weeks, in the month or so. Largely because Mousavi's rise came quite late, and part of this was due to media control, and he didn't really get his any sort of attention till the last few weeks. So it wasn't something, predicted by too many observers, to be honest, what's transpired in Iran. But I think there was a real sense that there was a real kind of to and fro between people who were ready to open up, and those forces aren't insignificant, and a smaller and smaller group who still tied to the revolution, nationalist revolutionaries, while reducing in popular appeal, still have the guns. And this at the moment, if you like, is the crucial thing. They've essentially been able to maintain, the status quo through force. And how long that lasts, we can't say for sure, but certainly the popular will seems to have shifted fairly dramatically. But that remains to be seen. Now, again, I was referring to the murder by a single shot by Nida. Now, Martyrdom is a very powerful force in Shia Iran, which sort of has these 3, 7, 40-day mourning cycles for the dead. It has parades of ceremonies sort of commemorating in a kind of, as I mentioned, a kind of self-flagellating grief, the death of members of the Prophet's family. Now, hence, I really hope that, I guess, the collective memory of the martyrs of this time will have a real impact over the coming years and transform this the society a little bit more. And I think there's a real possibility of that. Now, I think I'll just summarise and leave any further discussion to after the talk. Now, I've given you essentially a summary of recent events in two very different countries, but both rooted in an Islamic identity that are being torn at the seams. Now, I believe their utopian model is in part derived from prior utopian thinkers of the 20th century. Now, in both states, the people are rejecting the failed promise of a just and equal society that stands apart from the West based on Islamic ideas. But also in both states, the forces of Islamism have guns and are maintaining some kind of grip with an iron fist. In Pakistan, the forces are less organised and being met with state force, whereas in Iran, the popular will is being suppressed, at least for now. They are both examples of the yearning that two countries with very young populations, half the populations in both Iran and Pakistan, are under 30. This is a real yearning, which I think globalisation really contributes to, and they're connected to the world through modern communications technology. There's a real yearning, a quest to be part of the global order and the opportunities and promise that it can offer. And it's clear that this yearning is not being satisfied by political Islam at the moment. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew and Ahmed. We've got till 7 o'clock. A lot of people here have got to be quick with our comments. Can I just start you off? I was in New Delhi in September when the bombs went off in Islamabad, and as you know, later on, where the attacks on Mumbai. We know pretty well what the Mumbai attacks were about, but why would a terrorist group attack a major five-star hotel within Pakistan? What's the thinking among the people you spoke to on your visit about the explanation for that kind of attack within Pakistan?
I think this is certainly limited to Pakistan, but this is where some modern Islamic ideas, what begins as a kind of colonial resentment, then ties in with a kind of modern global version of a form of political Islam, which overlaps very much with terrorism. So in their minds, this is the thinking. I'm angry. I see Pakistan, the Pakistani state, as being tied to the West. This link is stopping us from becoming an Islamic utopia, which I'm supporting. By me attacking Western tourists, I'm essentially attacking one and the whole thing, if you like. And through this, I'm having the maximum impact, both in terms of media coverage, but also consistent with what's a, obviously a kind of warped ideology, and a fairly new, it's quite a, it's actually one born of modernity, not necessarily ancient ideas of Islam. It's a marriage between the politics of resentment, anti-colonialism, and modern Islamism.
You mentioned the large number under 30 and their yearning to have maybe some of the standards of the West. How do you see it possible for there to be some sort of an enlightenment that will actually allow a transition from this medieval thinking to something that would be consistent with the sort of development they're yearning for?
Well, I think Iran actually shows a good example of how that may be possible. You suddenly have a government that's completely out of step with a populace. So you have suddenly have a populace that's well-educated, that's plugged into the modern world, that is sophisticated, is largely secular, and want what the modern world has to offer, but is essentially sitting underneath, as I said, a clerical superstructure that is also linked with the bureaucrats and people with guns. So that's what's holding them back. Whereas in Pakistan, you do not have that. So hence, essentially, I guess more medieval ideas, A, are more easily sold and can be attractive to groups that see no way, see no hope, I guess, of their aspirations being filled. Now, in Pakistan, recent stats by a group called Human Rights Watch in Pakistan, the average age of the suicide bomber in the last 3 years in Pakistan is 16 or 17. So that gives you an idea that it's almost this youthful rebellion gone completely nuts, and where a real hopeless sense for some of this youthful rage, this is how it's being expressed. And certainly that's why I think the civil society aspects are so fundamental, and especially with such a young population, if you can have, as any development expert will tell you, that the one thing you were going to do in terms of development, it's educate girls. So in Pakistan, particularly this upcoming generation, unless that sector is dramatically changed, there'll still be a real, real problem there.
There's a question here.
Sorry.
Yeah. Just talking about your ideas in terms of the reasons behind why things are in that region, how do you feel and what will it take to make the correction in Iran to a government that will represent this new wave?
I guess the short answer is I don't know. But I guess if you look at history, it's very difficult, especially in the modern world where people can see what's around them well beyond their shores, and this is certainly the case in Iran. I just don't think it's possible for any length of time to have a government that's so out of step with the broader population, especially such a youthful population who just do not want the repression and the social regulation that's given to them. I remember there was a good, I think it was in the LA Times, there was an Iranian blogger who wrote a piece, and he wrote it anonymously, without a byline, and this was only a month or so ago, and he spoke of the Bazouchi, I don't think I've pronounced it terribly well, who were essentially the moral police, if you like, who go around, you know, beating people because they weren't wearing headscarves, similar to Saudi Arabia. And I remember that he had a quote, he was saying, and it's something I felt too, where he speaks of the people he thought that were attracted to that were often it was often the most socially awkward, who had very difficult who had a lot of difficulty, say, interacting. And I think his words were, these were the guys that had no chance of getting a date. Then they suddenly they went to the government. The government gave them guns and said they were special. And this is the problem. You look at any of the, I guess, the fascist forces or the repressive forces throughout history, particularly in the last 100, 200 years, and I just don't think it's possible for any length of time. What may happen is that the current political regime will give in a little, especially if they see themselves under threat. Khomeini, he's a shrewd politician. He may well think, OK, I'll have to give a little bit of ground to keep myself in. So you may see a period where a little bit of ground is given. It could be suddenly the parliament is given a little bit more power and the clerical part is sidelined a little, and that continues for a certain period. Now, remember, most people in Iran actually support, some form of Islam as part of their, underpinning their democracy or underpinning their country, but certainly not the level at which it is today. So short answer, I don't know, but at the same time, I can't see how steadily the current situation could not be eroded.
Look, my sense is that the rural poor in Iran and the urban poor continue, by and large, to support Ahmadinejad. It's safe to suggest that a majority of people in Iran want these reforms, certainly the urban statistics do. What statistics do you have to support the assertion that the majority of Iranians want change?
I don't, to be honest. This is ultimately just from, and nobody does, to be honest. But it's more a lot of the election results suggested. There's certainly a lot of evidence suggesting that it was highly likely the election results were rigged. Most recently, one of the biggest protests in one of the main squares, and again, what you've asserted was certainly thought by many Western intellectuals, and probably myself as well. But I know a couple of great reports I read about that was there was a real surprise about this, where there was 2 million people in one of the main squares the day after which Nedir Soltan was killed. The spread of the population that came out to the square was much broader than expected, and included, admittedly it was limited to Tehran and outer Tehran, but included certainly the urban poor. Now, I couldn't comment on the rural poor, but I think certainly the whole Ahmadinejad often ran on these themes of justice and social justice. And one, countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran, with oil prices coming down, they'll have much more trouble buying out the populace, if you like. And that will also threaten their power. But also images like Nedir Soltan getting killed and a whole range of injustices that's become very clear in after these elections, I think will really eat away at Ahmadinejad's, projection of justice as this figure of justice. And I think that has occurred.
Okay. You talk about the young being against the clerical establishment. Is it an age thing, or is it? Are there any up and coming young clerical types?
Look, I think that's a great question. I actually think that's a broader thing on much of the Islamic world. So if you think of the last 20, 30 years throughout the world, we've had a real democratisation, if you like, which has really flattened structures in a whole range of ways. So this is a part of the reason why a lot of Islamic structures and any sort of top-down structure of various kinds. And as a doctor, you often notice that too, where everyone turns up and they often know as much as you do because they've got access to a lot of the information. How to apply that is different. But you get that sense where you have these, I guess, monolithic patriarchies, very top-down, who are really struggling. The only way they can maintain some sort of authority is through force. And I know a lot of commentators suggest this. What the protests you've seen recently, it's arguably the first time where there's been an open challenge to the very legitimacy of the Grand Ayatollah. So people are threatening, well, I actually don't believe in your legitimacy anymore. Similar to what happened with the Shah 30-odd years ago, where people just didn't buy into the dynasty kind of myth. And a similar thing is going on now. So I think a lot of it is generational. And what you ask, when you have half the population under 25 that don't have access to the levers of power or their voices being heard, and it's a similar thing, I would also state, it's not a dissimilar thing to what you see in ethnic societies within the West, and particularly Islamic groups. So even just in the suburbs of Sydney, where you'll often find very difficult for young voices to come out, it's often taken the broader media to bring out West, I guess, young voices, not unlike myself, rather than the communities themselves. So I think the generational thing is a big part of it.
Okay, so we've got a little question here. Yeah.
Can I just ask about the elite in Pakistan? You said there's the military and the liberal elite.
Yeah.
Do they mix much at all? Do they get on? Are they the same people?
No. Interestingly, no. I think there's a liberal intelligentsia that essentially sort of half in Pakistan and half around the world. So the kids will be educated overseas. They'll often live in the UK and the States and possibly Australia as well. Most of them would either yearn to leave or do leave, and will, I guess, do little bits here and there where they can to influence. But the power in Pakistan is primarily A, in the army, who notably also control large sections of the economy, who often have levers over the major corporations. And then you have this rural landowning class who own, the whole Hindi word is zamindar, which was a big feature of of the British colonial days. One of the key differences between India's formation and Pakistan's formation was that this rural landowning class was essentially skewered in India. And that allowed for a kind of formation of a more credible democracy. This is yet to occur in Pakistan, which makes it very difficult for a credible democracy.
We don't have a lot of time, so you've got to be brief. There's a question here.
Okay. It seems as though we have nothing much to fear from Islamists, in the sense that what we had to fear with Nazi Germany and communism was an enormous industrial complex, could have waged a big war. But the only fear we can have, and I don't think buying up a few hotels is very, not nasty, but not frightening, but if they get nuclear weapons, we are in a very bad situation. How sure are you that they won't get that?
Pakistan government's got nuclear weapons, but the Islamists haven't got nuclear weapons.
I totally agree. And obviously that's the key fear. Hillary Clinton spoke about it too, and that is
and Iran.
At the end of this the tree diagram, if you like, this is the most worrisome end point. Certainly the indicators are now that there's very little or no threat of that at this stage. And because I think a lot of it's still far from the power, the hearts of Pakistan where this is occurring. It's usually on the fringes, and they certainly haven't really, it's still fairly sporadic, not terribly organised, and they really haven't, made any inroads onto the levers of power. And ultimately, I know you heard early in the year, you'd often hear predictions that Pakistan was on the verge of failing and the extremists were, 100 kilometres from Islamabad or something. It was widely reported. But really, the army is a massive, very organised entity, and I think it was overstated, a lot of that. And I think we'll see more of that in the upcoming year or so. But it's more that sinister religiosity, what I was speaking on, that is almost an equal of threat. And that's more, now the Taliban is losing legitimacy, which is a good thing. But the fear, said before, was more this combination of a creeping religiosity with the growing power of, say, Taliban-like elements. But at least for now, I think it's receded a little. But I think it remains to be seen whether that resurfaces.
Like your comment on this, some time ago, I took a taxi from the airport in Sydney to my home. It was a trip of about 45 minutes. And I started the talk with the taxi driver.
Okay, we've got to be quick. Okay. We haven't got 45 minutes.
And he was silent. And I asked him, why did he migrate to this country? And your mention of a civil ageing reminded me of this. He told me, I have a very beautiful daughter and I came to this country to protect her. Because in Pakistan, she could be taken from me at the whim of a member of the civil ageing. Who happened to see her, who happened to come into contact with her and could take possession of her. Do you have any comment on that? Is that feasible or was it exaggerated?
It seems exaggerated, but I mean, he was living there, so I mean, he could be that something happened to one of his friends, and certainly there's more possibility of, I guess, criminal activity, and as I mentioned, the justice system is particularly poor. But the broader theme of why they would migrate here, I mean, the yearning is primarily for, I guess, to give, like any of us, to give their children a better chance, I think. Just to give them, I guess, chance at a better job, a chance of really being plugged into the world, which they would often see in their own countries as not being feasible. And you find many of these people, they'll often spend a period where, even though there was opportunities for them overseas, they'll often stay back for a little while, 5, 10 years, if you like, thinking, right, no, I'll try and apply my skills here. And many of them, I know even amongst my relatives too, where there usually often comes a period or a specific event where they think, no, it's just... You know, they pack it in, really, I think, especially as their kids get older. You'll often find that's when, the threshold is reached.
Final question from Duncan, who always takes the train from the airport, so... Okay, yeah.
Followed by the ferry, yes. But what are some of the latest rumours you hear about where Bin Laden and his colleagues are, and what are the rumours about the search for that particular individual?
I have little or no expertise in that region. Well, I did see some report that his son was killed I have no idea. I'd be very surprised if he was from as a doctor. I know reading about him over the last few years that he had a fairly significant kidney condition, which needed fairly regular dialysis. I'd be very surprised if he was still alive. He may acquire this kind of Elvis type. mythical character that you see him walking the streets of Sydney or something. But I'd be very surprised if he was still alive.
Truth is, he's sometimes disguised as a Sydney taxi driver. I'm a great admirer of Dr. Shamir Ahmed. I follow his columns every month in the Sydney Morning Herald with great interest. He's spoken to us before. He has a wide knowledge in lots of areas, and I think his knowledge of medicine gives a great insight to some of his other judgments about political causes. So it was great to have him on tonight talking about Pakistan and Iran. No doubt you'll be back again in the future, and we're very happy to run your paper in the Sydney papers, and we'll go up on our podcast within a day or so. So many thanks and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.